Thank you for joining us for another podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California.
Good evening and welcome to tonight's program hosted by the Commonwealth Club of Silicon Valley. My name is Ladaris Cordell. It is my pleasure to introduce Keyser Khan, Gold Star father and author of An American Family, a memoir of hope and sacrifice. Mr. Khan was born in Pakistan and received his law degree from the University of Punjab. He and his wife, Ghazala, then lived in Dubai before immigrating with their family to the United States. In 1986, Mr. Khan graduated from Harvard Law School, and that same year, the Khans became American citizens. The Khans have three sons, Shahryar, Humayun, and Omar. U.S. Army Captain Humayun was tragically killed in the line of duty in Iraq and posthumously awarded a Purple Heart and a Bronze Star. Many of us remember Mr. Khan delivering one of the most memorable speeches at last year's Democratic National Convention as he talked about equality, sacrifice, and the ideals symbolized by the United States Constitution. We are honored to have him with us here tonight. Please welcome Keyser Khan. Thank you, first of all, Mr. Khan, for being here. And you told me just a moment ago that you have made how many appearances just in San Francisco in the area? How many?
Well, this is 176th appearance.
Amazing.
Before throughout the country.
Amazing.
And fourth time in San Francisco.
Wow. So everyone everywhere remembers your remarks at the Democratic National Convention on July 28th, 2016, the fourth and last night of the convention. In your moving memoir, An American Family, you wrote that it was your wife, Ghazala, who edited your words down to the required 2 minutes when you held up your copy of the Constitution. And when you did that, the place went wild. She even had you practice pulling it out of your shirt pocket.
Right.
But everyone, your friends, your wife advised you not to accept the invitation to speak, and you decided not to speak. What changed your mind? What happened?
Sure. Judge Cordell, I'm grateful first for this blessed place to invite me, and I'm so honored to be sitting under your grace. Thank you.
The feeling is mutual, my
friend.
Thank
you. Thank you. But before I answer your question, I wish to pay tribute to our veterans. Thank you for your service, your family's service. Without your service to this blessed nation, our liberty, our freedoms would have been in jeopardy. So we are grateful to you for that. Thank you.
Amen.
I also wish to pay my sincere thanks and our tribute to all men and women serving in uniform today, and the members of the law enforcement and their families for their sacrifice, for their service, keeping us safe and keeping us moving forward. We are grateful to you. Thank you. Your Honor, this journey had been an amazing journey for me, and the story of our family would not be complete unless Ghazala had joined me. It's because of her blessed presence that made my family complete, and what we write in the book has become just an excuse, a vehicle, a vessel to carry the story of all immigrants. It's a story of immigration, everyone that comes to this blessed nation, goes through this process of becoming a citizen. But coming to this speech writing, when we received the invitation, everyone told us, do not go. Our two sons told us, do not go. This is not your cup of tea. Our well-wishers, I called them next. I thought they were, our children were being overly protective of us. I called a couple of our well-wishers in Charlottesville, and they told us, no, do not participate in this. This could be too overwhelming for you, and this could be very burdensome. So we sat for 2 days, and should we or shouldn't we? And we sat in the room where Captain Humayun Khan's portrait is hung, and wandering in our minds. And Ghazala and I spoke, should we or shouldn't we? And prior to then, small children of elementary school, middle school, had been asking me after that bigoted statement that all Muslims should be thrown out of here and Muslims should be banned, all Hispanics should be thrown out, women don't deserve equal dignity, judges are partial, and all that sort of bigoted statements then candidate Trump made. So children would come to us and would ask, you're a lawyer, you practice law, is this possible that we will be thrown out of here? But we were born here. These are elementary school kids, middle school kids. And I would pull out the Constitution from my pocket and I would read it to them, 14th Amendment, Section 1, equal protection, due process, and all. But children were not heartened. So the invitation came and we waited for 2 days. Second day, we decided that it really is a little too much for us to go. And then comes the card. I go to check the mail, and we tell that story in the book in great detail. I go to check the mail, and in the mail there is a card, and that card sent us there. That card was written by 4 middle school students, their names and name of a school on top, and this is the line that sent us there. The line says, Mr. Mrs. Khan, would you make sure that Maria is not thrown out of this country? We love her. She's our friend. I looked at the card and walked fast to the home. And in the living room, Ghazala was there. I showed her. I said, maybe our answer has come. We had been praying and we had been thinking what Captain Humayun Khan would do under these circumstances. On one hand is our peace and our quiet and our dignity and our comfort. On other hand are these children that are asking us, are we going to be thrown out and all. So she looked at the card and she tells me, call them. Wow. We will go.
Wow.
And we went.
That's right.
So I wrote to answer your speech question. I sat down after we called them. I sat down to write my grievances, 1 page, 2 page, 12 pages. Stories of these children, how worried they were, how they were not eating, they were not sleeping, they were not wanting to go to school since they heard that statement. The very first line of that. So next morning, after I wrote those pages, I asked Ghazala to sit with me with the clock in her hand and see if I could read all those 12 pages in 2 minutes.
Mission impossible.
Yeah. So I started to read 5 minutes, 10 minutes, 12 minutes, 18 minutes. And she had never called me Mr. Khan. That day she did. She said, Mr. Khan, they will turn your microphone off. So let's cut it down. And the very first, look at the caliber of Ghazala. The very first sentence she deleted from the speech was this. My first sentence was, these are my words. I have not plagiarized them from Mrs. Obama's speech.
Out.
She said no. She said no, you will not say that.
Right.
Take it out.
Take it out.
So she took it out. So we winded up 230 words.
Beautiful words.
And here we are.
Mr. Khan, can you talk to us about the Constitution? What is it about this document that so endears it to you? And when did you first discover the U.S. Constitution?
Yeah, that love affair, people wonder why am I so passionate about the U.S. Constitution. All three documents, when we use the word Constitution, I mean all three parts of it, Declaration of Independence, the Articles, and the Bill of Rights. My love affair started in 1972 with the Constitution. The very first, I took a course, I was 22 years old in Pakistan in second year of law school, and I took a course that the title was Comparative Study of Constitutions of the World. Four constitutions were included in it. Constitution of USSR, yes, there used to be Soviet Union. Because of the usurpation of the rights of the people, it disintegrated because people were not given their rights. And anyway, so Constitution of USSR, then Germany, then Magna Carta, which is the foundation of the British legal system, and then was the U.S. Constitution. So I brought the materials, and I have such a vivid memory of that moment when I placed those documents on the corner of my dormitory table. It was afternoon, and my eyes went to the top of the page, and it said, July 1776, Declaration of Independence. I had lived in colonized part of the world, subcontinent, and I knew a little bit history of colonization. You don't declare your independence. There had been no nation that declared its independence. Independence is given. You protest, you complain, you ask, and you beg, and you continue to appeal. And when the colonist feels that there is nothing else they can extract from you, then you are given independence. But look at this nation that is declaring independence in 1776. Why we had to suffer another 200 years, rest of the mankind. So I was in awe of that very first word. So standing there, I remember my feet begin to hurt because I was trying to read the entire Declaration of Independence, all 1,338 words of it. In one standing, my feet were hurting, so I took my shoes off and I remained standing and reading, and I read all of the grievances that are listed in there. So the love affair started then.
You are the oldest of nine children, born and raised in Pakistan. Can you tell us a bit about your upbringing and why you weren't raised in the home of your parents for the first several years of your life?
I come from a very modest family, and I am the firstborn. And 2 years after was my brother was born, and then another brother. And this is what I'm told, that my grandparents were retired, and they had more resources than my parents did. So they asked if I could be living with them, in the same city, but living with them. My parents had no objection. They could allocate more resource and more attention to me than my parents could. So I spent my early childhood with my grandparents in their home. And listening to those wonderful stories, I share that in the book, that moonlight, we did not have electricity. Moonlit nights were amazingly beautiful nights there, and my grandfather would come every night and sit with me and would tell me a story. If the light was stronger, he would read. If the light was not that strong, light of the moon was not that strong, then he would simply paraphrase and would share his stories. And amazing moments now that I reflect back at the effect of his presence and both grandparents' presence and their affection, how they lived, and I learned from them. There is one saying that I share that he used to often recite. It says, "So what if you're thirsty? Be river for others."
Be a river for others.
Others. So right. That was the kind of nights I spent with them, and I'm blessed and so honored.
Your memoir is as much about you as it is about Ghazala, your wife. Your description of how you courted her is a wonderful love story. Would you just take a briefly tell us about her, her royalty roots, and how it was that you two were married over the phone?
Yes. Yeah. Well, she comes from a wonderful family, and she did not tell me that at all when I met her. First few months, I wasn't aware of it. It was her teacher that told me, her mentor, her advisor, her thesis advisor, that told me her background, that she's writing the thesis about her family's contribution to the Persian literature. And I was just amazed at the modesty of this wonderful lady, that she comes from such a blessed family and with such a contribution to literature, and when I became aware of it, I was just totally in awe, and I knew since then that I am not I don't deserve her, but I had begun to like her and all, and so I would find excuses to be around her and talk to her, and it's been an amazing journey with her.
It's a great story, but a little bit about, you got married over the phone.
Yeah, so. I was in Dubai, and right. I was just beginning to earn my living and wanted to save, and so I thought that traveling back to get married would be an unnecessary expense. And so it is permissible. There is no restriction on it, as long as you have witnesses and you announce in the community and the legal documents are signed and all. So we decided that she agreed as well. She said, yes, we are starting our life together, and we need resources for that. Instead of having a big reception and a big pre-marriage and post-marriage ceremonies, why don't we just get married and use the phone? And so we tell that story in great detail in
the
book.
And she, so you were in Dubai, she was in Pakistan.
That's right. Her family and my family had gotten together. They were all there. Everybody, all the witnesses, and all the licensing part was done, and everyone was there.
And you just had to say, "I do."
Yes, I do, and I do, and I do, over the phone.
Sounds good to me.
Yes.
It does. I think, Mr. Khan, that only you could find a connection between the 14th Amendment and the Department of Motor Vehicles, DMV. Yeah. You made this connection between the 14th Amendment and the DMV, when you went to the DMV to get your driver's license. Could you tell us, what is the connection between the 14th Amendment and the DMV?
Oh, well, there is everyday connection. I am, and I know where I'm sitting. I sit under your grace, Judge Cordell. I am fully aware of one of the salient features of our democracy is rule of law. Meaning we treat everyone with equal dignity. Everybody is treated with equality in the eyes of law. I had been in awe of these features, that characteristic of this nation and this society. So I was very much aware of what rule of law means, and I remain in awe of that even today. So I am new in Texas, and I go to get my driver's license, and I had known America's rule of law and equal protection, meaning everyone is treated equally. So I go to DMV, and I entered, and there's just big hall, lots of people sitting, and I entered, and I take the number. There's a sheriff at the door and says, please take the number and sit. So I take the number, and I sit down in the crowd, and I look at all sorts and all kind of people sitting, waiting for their turn. The clerk calls the number, and the person goes, gets things done and moving and all. To me, that was my very first experience how people should be treated equally. Even under those difficult circumstances, you're still treated equally. The reason why these comparisons are so sharp in my mind and in my heart and in my soul is that I have lived twice under martial law, where the dictator, the authoritarian, the oligarch, the dictator, the martial law administrator would decide what rights you have and what rights you do not have. Cousin of ministers would come from behind the door and get everything done and would walk out without waiting in line and all. That concept is so foreign to us, but it is so prevalent in that part of the world. So I came with that background and watching this equal treatment of all, same chair, same number, and same line of clerks calling and getting things done and all that. That was equal protection. That remains equal protection. Sure. Americans are surprised sometimes. My native-born American friends are surprised when I make the comparison of this, but that is the display of equal protection of law in American society.
You know, after reading the book, I'll never look at the DMV the same way.
Yeah, exactly.
The heck?
Exactly.
You are a lawyer trained in Pakistan. You earned a second law degree from Harvard. And when you were a student at Harvard, you were homeless for a time. Why was that, and how did you survive?
Well, I survived with the amazing honor and dignity. The reason was it was a brief period. I had just graduated, and I had started to work to make a living because I had two small children then and family to support. But I wanted to complete my education as well. Therefore, there was a delay of receiving a paycheck. I had the choice. I could have paid the rent, and I had rented the room, but I did not have the rent money to pay the rent in advance. So it was just a few nights that I spent in a park on a bench. But
if I remember right, it was 10 days.
Well,
and you were sleeping on a bench in the park. Is that right?
It was long ago. No, not at all. But it was for the purpose was that I had the choice, but my family's need and my children's need, I preferred that their needs should be met first. And so what?
So
what if you're thirsty?
River, right. Wow.
You are listening to the Commonwealth Club of California. Listen to thousands of our podcasts on iTunes or Google Play. And when you're in the Bay Area, please join us live for one of our 450 programs each year. You can find us online at commonwealthclub.org. And now, back to our program.
Later, as a lawyer, I found this fascinating. You were an expert witness in cases involving divorcing Muslim couples. And your story about the first time you testified as an expert witness is just a terrific story. Just briefly, what happened?
Well, I am proponent of women's right, not because it is a fashionable statement to make. No, not at all. from the very beginning. It's because of the fairness. Whenever anyone that is treated unfairly and the system is manipulated to treat the other person unfairly, I am for the person that is being treated unfairly. And it is that I have appeared in many, many cases as an expert witness sometime as an amicus, meaning friend of the court, to advise the court and advise the judges that these documents that are being presented are mean nothing in United States. This case that that you're mentioning, in that case, husband, a millionaire, was presenting a marriage certificate as a prenup agreement. And when I was contacted, I looked at their assertion, and I was just so annoyed at this exploitation of these religious documents. That was a marriage certificate. Witnessing the marriage, it has nothing to do with prenup agreement. And the other side was presenting it that she only gets $100. This person was a millionaire. So I traveled, I went, and I appeared before the family court, and I humbly suggested that this, Your Honor, the court is being misled by the other side. This document is a marriage contract, not a marriage a marriage certificate, not a prenup agreement. And the other side had brought Imam, and the other side had brought a couple of other people that were saying that in Islamic tradition, this document is all, and it lists all of the all that divorcing spouses will give to one another and share the property. But that is not the case. That is misinterpretation of the law. That is misinformation. And my humble suggestion to the court was that, Your Honor, we live in the United States. We have family laws, and family laws should apply. But if you applied law of any other jurisdiction, any other country, and that is where this Sharia coming, this is out of ignorance. Those who say that Sharia is coming, we should be afraid, and all of this, they neither know Sharia, nor they know their own constitution protections and constitutional law. In our constitution, there is a provision called equal protection of law, meaning that regardless of our gender, we all will be treated equally. Therefore, if any law, any document that treats based on gender, there is a discrimination on that, that document will not be accepted by the court. So my suggestion was accepted. And since then, I have appeared in many courts advising the courts that that these claim of Sharia are just so bogus, because I have studied Islamic law. I was trained as a lawyer in Islamic jurisprudence, and I have studied American constitutional law. I know what it means, application of equal protection. Therefore, this bogus statements, when these statements are made, I wish that our nation would ask them, those who make this statement that Sharia is coming and Sharia will take over and all that, have you read your own constitution? Do you even understand your own constitution? Yeah. And so it is for that. Thank you.
Excellent.
Thank you.
Wow. You write, and this is in your book, 11 years, 5 months, and 29 days after Captain Humayun Khan was killed serving his country, Donald Trump was on my television screen. Trump stared at a sheet of paper in his hands. Donald J. Trump, he began, is calling for a total and complete shutdown of Muslims entering the United States until our country's representatives can figure out what the hell is going on. This was 5 days after the mass killing of 14 people in San Bernardino, California, by a husband and wife who were Muslim. What was your reaction to Trump's rhetoric and to the shootings?
Well, to the shootings that we all are responsible for our safety, for the safety of our nation, each and every one of us must remain vigilant. And anyone that raises a malice eye or hand should be reported and should be arrested and put behind bars. We should never be we should always be vigilant in keeping to keep our nation, our country safe. Violence, regardless of be it here or anywhere else, I reject that. And we all need to unite, especially Muslims and all other communities must unite together to eradicate this menace of terrorism from this planet Earth. Whenever we talk about the victims of terrorism, Muslims are the most victim. Innocent women, children, and men in Muslim countries are the most victim of menace of terrorism. So we reject that. There is no room for this. I am bound by my religious tradition that I cannot say that, oh, you are not Muslim because you have committed this violence against innocent people. I cannot say that. But I do not know what faith they practice. What definition of my faith they have that they commit violence, either be it here or Europe or elsewhere. I totally reject that. And when that statement was made, what I was afraid was that it will begin to alienate Muslim community, not only in the United States, but the reaction of that against my sons and daughters serving overseas in the armed forces, because they rely on the support of Muslims when they are serving in Muslim countries, and that will be very risky. And that had been the reaction. If you talk to those who serve in the armed forces that were deployed overseas or are deployed overseas, whenever this president makes such statements, they are the one that are facing the risk. And so it was that concern, and that those who do not wish us well find a soft corner. They say, see, this is what we are talking about. And then the mischief begins to gain ground in our communities.
In 1973, this country ended the draft. Do you think that we should reinstate it? Now, I ask that because with the draft, most American families would have far more at stake when our political leaders embroil the country in a war of choice. Now, undoubtedly, the last 16 years of war would have unfolded differently if the sons and daughters of the politicians and the wealthy had to fight. So what do you think?
Well, I have been not in favor of America's involvement in these wars, but we must protect our nation. We must protect our interest, be it here or overseas. It's beyond my grade to decide whether there should be a draft or not. But participation in defense of this nation. It's an honor. It's those who serve our nation are the most honorable citizens of this country, and we should encourage our young men and women to join our armed forces and serve. I recently met a former president and his wife in Atlanta. Amazing story. This was Mr. and Mrs. Carter in Atlanta, and I asked them after I asked about their well-being and all. He's 93 years old, and Mrs. Carter is 90 years old, and they're in excellent health and all. So I asked him that out of wishing you well, what is the secret of this wonderful life? And he said one word, and that is service. Those who serve are the happiest people, are healthiest people, and are the most content people among our nation. And so his advice was one word, service. So it is that service is so honorable, and be it via draft, be it voluntarily, it must be honored. And this nation honors. We honor our members of our armed forces, our law enforcement, and their families with amazing honor. So if need, if there is a need, then definitely we should have the draft so everyone participates in defending this nation and its values.
Interesting. You and Ghazala are the parents of three sons, and it was your middle son, Humayun, captain in the army, who was killed in Afghanistan. In the book, your description of your family's learning of his death is absolutely heart-wrenching. But what you and Ghazala have done since his death is heartwarming. Can you tell us what you all do now?
Well, thank you. Proceeds of these, there are two books now, not one, but two books. I'll tell you about the second book. This is called This Is Our Constitution. It's written for our middle school children, middle school students. And I'll share that with you, how this came into being. But this is what we do. I feel that there is a need for a voice on behalf of our Constitution, on behalf of our democracy, that I must continue to speak. And I'll share with you a letter that we have received that keeps me going day after day after day. From the proceeds of these two books, we have established a scholarship at University of Virginia in Charlottesville. The title of that scholarship is Captain Humayun Khan Memorial Scholarship. It's in perpetuity, and it's on need-based. And the first award of that scholarship was this semester to a freshman. And that freshman wrote us a card, and we were so delighted to read that card. And in that card, the recipient writes, saying that, thank you for making college education possible for me. It is that goodness continues to come out of Captain Humayun Khan's life and his sacrifice. Yes, all of us have two choices. One is we sit home and cherish and enjoy our peace and quiet and let the affairs take care of them itself and let someone else worry about them. Or we participate, we stand up and we do our part and we set sail. So we have set sail and see where we land and where we wind up. You asked and folks ask about this traveling and speaking. It's because of this. Among thousands and thousands of letters that we have received at home, if you came home, we will show you amazing respect, dignity, love, encouragement that has poured throughout the world and United States. There is one letter that I always recite, and that letter is 26-page letter written by a retired Army nurse. She served in Second World War. And in 25 pages, she narrates her story, what she saw, what she observed, how she served in Second World War in Europe. On 26th page, she writes this. And it is that 26th page that continues, that inspires me every day when I'm so tired that I cannot get up, I'm not feeling well, I don't want to get up, but I get up when I think of that 26th page. This is what it says. It says, Mr. and Mrs. Khan, please continue to speak. Had there been more people speaking before Second World War in Europe, we could have avoided Second World War. Mm-hmm. We could have avoided the atrocities that were committed against mankind in Second World War. We could have avoided the atrocities that were committed against our Jewish brothers and sisters. We could have avoided all that, so continue to speak. It is that, for that purpose. We are going through a tumultuous time. It is momentary. It is momentary. Declaration of Independence was written 240 years ago. Our Constitution and all this came into being 230 years ago. We just celebrated 230 years of our Constitution coming together. So these values have survived. We will survive this tumultuous time as well. Throughout the nation, whenever I travel, people ask me, why are you so hopeful? Here is the reason why I am so hopeful. Because some folks ask me, show us the proof. Why are you so hopeful? You travel one community to another community, Portland, Oregon, Texas, Austin, Houston, Pittsburgh, Toledo, Des Moines, Iowa, Cedar Rapids, Iowa, Indianapolis, Minnesota, all of states and communities. This is the proof of hopefulness. Everyone asks the same question. We are so concerned. Where do we go from here? We are concerned about the well-being of our values, of our constitution, of our rule of law, of our liberties and freedoms and our democracy. I offer this proof to you. I come from Charlottesville, Virginia. Yes, same Charlottesville, where that ugliness was displayed on 12th of August and 13th of August. My daughter, I call her my daughter out of affection, Heather Hare, was murdered by that car driver. So the attack of this hate and division on Charlottesville was responded, very few people know this, was responded by Charlottesville on Wednesday night. On Wednesday night, Charlottesville decided that we will all come out and we will show our children what America is all about. Thousands of families, without making announcement, no media announcement, no television or radio announcement, word of mouth, thousands of families came, and we walked on the same route where that neo-Nazi flag was on display, where those neo-Nazi chants were on display. And we peacefully walked, candles in our hands, our children with us, our families with us. We went to the sacred grounds of University of Virginia. We stood there and we showed our children, this is what America is all about. That moment of hate and division is not us. Then few days or few weeks later, we saw exactly same reaction. There were 24 symbol of hate and division showed up in Boston, and 40,000 Bostonians showed up to repel their ugliness and their hatred and their division. And then came, and this is where the hope lies. This is the proof of hope, that with hope, and Virginia realized there is only one way, and I leave you with that message to think about. There is only one way to preserve our democracy, to preserve all the dignities that are enshrined in our Constitution, all of our liberties, came 7th of November last month. Virginia, I saw with my own eyes line after line after line of men, women, and children standing to vote. I paid very close attention, sneakers, overcoats, umbrella in their hand, just in case if it rains. Overcoats somewhere were worn and somewhere just on the arm because it may get cold. Lines were long, so they were wearing sneakers. Children were with them. To show that in democracy, that is how you take charge of your destiny. And we showed it to the rest of the country. We will do exactly same state by state by state, and we will take our country back. So I went and I took a day from the schedule to go and campaign in New Jersey for Phil Murphy. And exactly same thing, I went to the Muslim communities, to veterans, to other immigrant communities. In one day, several events, and I urged that 7th of November in the life of American patriots, American citizen, is a sacred day. That is when we exercise our power. because we have not been doing this, look at the result. Our democracy is under attack. Captain Humayun Khan wrote a letter, wrote an article long time ago when he was at University of Virginia. He wanted to gain admission to a dormitory, which is a nicer dormitory to live in, and that admission requires writing an essay. So he wrote an essay. The title of that essay was "Democracy Requires Vigilance and Sacrifice." We have not been vigilant. It is so true to my simple mind that the world is divided in two parts. One is authoritarians, dictators, oligarchs, corrupt leaders that usurp our rights, ordinary citizens' rights. They are the richest and they are the most powerful. On the other hand, we have democratic people. Democratic meaning we decide who will guide us, who would lead us. We decide what laws will be adopted. We do make mistakes. Like last election, we made a mistake. But we have option to fix it next time. And so it is that, whether we can have all the oligarchs, all the autocrats, all the authoritarian mentality. I have lived, as I mentioned, twice under martial law, where I had no rights, no dignities. I could not step out of my home when I was a student. First, when I was in middle school, second time when I was in law school. Twice I have lived under martial law without any dignity, without any freedom or liberty. So I know how it feels without these liberties that are guaranteed to us in our constitution. That is why I am so passionate to remind all of us that we must read these documents so we are fully aware of the blessings. It is these universal truths that are, we call them Bill of Rights or Constitution. These are all universal truths. You talk to any person in the darkest corner of this earth among the mankind and ask them, do you want to have freedom of religion? Do you want to have freedom to speak? Do you want to have freedom to assemble and express your opinion? They will say yes. Where can we have it? We don't have it. The rest of the world doesn't. We are guaranteed in our constitution. It is that comparison that makes me so passionate that we must remain standing and we must remain firmly in support of these human dignities that have made us beacon of hope for the rest of the world. I have participated, Your Honor, in those conventions and conferences where rest of the world had come to learn our rule of law. How do you implement these laws? How do you dispense justice equally? It doesn't mean that there is no room for improvement. No, no, no. There is so much room to make it better. We are not there yet. We must continue to move forward, but we must be aware of what we have so we can preserve. Those who do not like us, those who do not like our democracy, our democratic values, and our democratic system, are after us. They are after our democracy. Last election you saw, in 2016 election you saw, that how they cyber attacked us, how they interfered in the integrity of our election system, of our the system of government, system of running our elections and conducting our elections. And so they have not given up. They did exactly same thing in Europe at Brexit. They are finding out that there was foreign intervention in their affairs. So it is that we need to be aware of so that we can protect, we can move forward, and we will prevail. Virginia is the proof of it. We prevailed.
So given what you've just said, I'm going to turn to questions from the audience. This is the perfect follow-up question. Are you going to run for public office?
No. Thank you.
And if not, why not?
Well, here is the reason that I think the work still needs to be done nationwide. We need to continue to speak. We need to continue to... I do this all pro bono. All of my speaking engagements have been pro bono. I think this nation has blessed me with so much dignity and so much honor. Let me share with you quickly... when I became citizen, and I wish each and every American would read that oath of citizenship, I paused for a moment before I entered the federal courtroom to take the oath of citizenship. There were so many others, I paused. I had studied law. I have lived under two martial laws, so I was fully aware what I did not have when, up until at the door of that court.
This was 1986?
This was in 1986, okay, when I become citizen. I am fully aware of those moments when newspapermen were shot, when the press were burned. Press is no good. Judges are partial. They do no justice. With that and everything was in the hands of martial law administrator. You can buy a bag of sugar or bag of rice only with his permission. With those indignities, I countered them in 2 minutes when I paused before I entered the courtroom. So I entered the courtroom, I took the oath of citizenship, I am given a certificate of citizenship. The title of that certificate says Certificate of Citizenship and Naturalization and Citizenship. I look at that certificate. To my humble eyes, those words did not mean citizenship or naturalization. To me, those meant certificate of human dignity. Now I am guaranteed my freedom of faith. I am guaranteed freedom of speech. I am guaranteed freedom to speak, freedom to assemble. These are all guaranteed to me in my constitution. And so it is that that makes me passionate, that makes me travel. So what if I'm tired? So what if you're thirsty?
How did you feel when your son decided to join the Army?
Yeah, I was not in favor of it because I am a student of history as well. Such engagements in that part of the world has not served America before or now. And only military families know the cost of such engagements. So I was not in favor of that, but he told me something. He said, look, I have taken the oath of office. I am a military officer. I don't think like that. I have taken the oath to defend the Constitution and protect men and women under my responsibility, and I will continue. So we sent him with our blessings.
This is another question. Mr. Khan, thank you for all you are doing. What would be your message to young Americans to stop the spread of hate as done by Mr. Trump?
Yeah, hate and division is equivalent to defeat. Wherever hate and division is practiced, you can see that they have adopted the defeat as their destiny. Therefore, that is not our destiny at all. America had not become beacon of hope because of its hate and because of its division. It has become a beacon of hope for the rest of the mankind because of its pluralism, meaning that it equal protection, equal dignity for all. Once you are, of course, we are responsible for its safety, for its security, for its that all of our citizens should be law-abiding citizens. But hate and division is a defeated mentality. Hate and division, I go back to two world wars. If you look at the script of the First World War and the Second World War, there were three elements common. First, nationalism. Second, economic well-being. Third, fear of immigrants. These three elements are common in First World War and Second World War. Look at the atrocities that this hate and division had caused throughout the world. Therefore, hate had its chance. Hate and division had its chance in last century. No more. We live in 2017. We need to move forward The more hands we join, we make our communities stronger, the better our future is going to be. I lately have been reading Declaration of Independence all over again for a specific purpose. There is a discussion of immigration in our nation. I read it and I remind myself there are 18 grievances talking about hate and division, because these days hate and division is mostly directed towards the immigrants, towards minorities. This is what our forefathers wrote in Declaration of Independence. I am not talking about last year or 10 years ago. 1776, this is what forefathers of our blessed nation wrote in Declaration of Independence. Grievance number 7, I have titled it number 7 because among 18, this is number 7. He has endeavored, he meaning the king has endeavored to prevent the population of these states for that purpose obstructing the laws for naturalization of foreigners, refusing to pass others to encourage their immigration here. Meaning we were griping to the king that you're not allowing us to have enough immigrants. The reason for that is that immigrants bring vitality. They bring, and that is what is the motto of this book that we have written. Our story is a story of every immigrant. We come with this spirit of making our life better. We work harder. We dedicate ourselves. 30% of the Nobel laureates of this nation are immigrants. This is what we bring to this nation. We parts, of course, there had to be laws. Of course, there had to be immigration laws, immigration policies. You, I'm sure most of you know, I am before the learned audience, we do not have immigration policy. We have immigration laws. We don't have immigration policies. And there's a difference between law and policy. Law meaning who can come, how you qualify, what forms to fill, how much fee to pay. But the policy is this, that how many people will be retiring in next 5 years, 10 years, 20 years? Who will be replacing them? What sector? Farming, technology, industry. What sectors would be needing how many people? How would we be training them? Where would these labor force come from? Instead of haphazardly every year, let's bring people from here, let's bring people from here, then maligning them by telling that, oh, they are taking your jobs. Right now, the figures that are reported, and please look into that, there are 7 million Americans unemployed at this time, especially young Americans. There are 6.2 million vacancies for technology jobs in the United States today. Those 7 million cannot be employed because we have not prepared them to be employed. It is that, and these politicians, they are taking advantage of that discrepancy. They are taking advantage and they are exploiting it. They are making it immigrants are bad. So these technology companies, the companies that need to run the industry, that need to run the country, they go and they get quota, they get permits, they bring people from other countries that are preparing their population to be employed in the technology industry, and they come up here, and then we begin to malign them that they have taken over our jobs. We have not prepared our youth. Why in every community college there should be a technology training courses throughout the year. Within few years, we can eliminate that discrepancy. But we have not paid attention. We have not allocated resources. It is very quick and it is very easy to practice hate and division against the vulnerable communities.
Unfortunately, we have reached the point in our program where we have time for one, just one last question. Mr. Khan, and what I'd like to do, with your permission, is to close our conversation with your reading a passage from An American Family. I found this passage in the book, and I just think it would be the perfect way time together here.
I'll be honored.
Thank you.
Uh, This is page 246. We still wonder what made him take those 10 steps, I said, explaining how he would walk towards the taxi. Maybe that's the point where all the values, all the service to the country, all the things he learned in this country kicked in. I watched Ghazala. Her eyes were wet with tears. It was those values that made him take those 10 steps. Those 10 steps told us we did not make a mistake in moving to this country. These were the values we wanted to adopt, not religious values, human values.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So, I hope that you all enjoyed this evening's program brought to you by the Commonwealth Club of Silicon Valley. We thank Khizr Khan, author of An American Family, a memoir of hope and sacrifice. We thank our audience here in Palo Alto and those of you joining us on the radio. And now, this meeting of the Commonwealth Club is adjourned. Thank you all so much. Thank you, Mr. Khan.